Following the meeting, Adamski showed the medallion to Lou and May, and it was ascertained from banks in Rome that the ecumenical coin had not been available officially until 2 weeks later. Also of relevance was the small plastic wallet in which the coin was wrapped. It bore the most singular inscription I have ever seen, protected by a transparent cover, said Lou. The written characters were of a very unusual kind, certainly neither Roman nor Gothic, nor were they Russian, Chinese, Japanese, Arabic, or Hebrew. 54. According to Major Peterson, Adamski had had another audience with Pope John XXIII. In confidential talks with Peterson during his trip to Europe in 1959, Adamski revealed that he had to attend an important meeting at the Vatican. "Are you to meet with the Pope?" asked Peterson. "I don't know, but it is possible," Adamski responded. "Orthon will also be there. He has been there 3 times before, twice during Pope Pius's time, 1939-1958, and once during Pope John's." 55. Was Christ of alien origin? It will be recalled that in Chapter 7, Henry Doohan implies that Orthon was the reincarnated Christ. My views about religions, per se, are ambivalent. While I am sure that profound truths have been passed down in the world's scriptures, should we not, objectively, acknowledge the numerous contradictions, inconsistencies, and sometimes altered translations over the centuries? Exactly how much is factual? For example, in a letter to a British newspaper, a reader aptly points out that, "We don't have his sermons in the original Aramaic, so must rely on varying, often conflicting, translations via the Koine Greek Gospels." Indeed, the use of parables by Jesus was a deliberate unclarity that puzzled the disciples, Matthew 13:10-14. Alas, much schismatic blood has been spilled ever since, arguing over the precise meaning of his far from clear and simple message. "How does Peter," another reader, parse, "think not that I am come to send peace on earth? I came not to send peace, but a sword," Matthew 10:34. 56. Nonetheless, if some of the biblical references to Jesus are more than apocryphal, such as the following, they support his out-of-this-world provenance. The visit to Mary by Gabriel, the angel, derived from Agelos, Greek for messenger, transliterated as Angelos, foretelling the Immaculate Conception. 57. An angel announcing the birth of the Christ, followed by the heavenly host of angels which afterwards departed into heaven, that is, the sky. 58. The star reported by the wise men which they had seen at its rising and went ahead of them until it stopped above the place where the child lay. 59. Jesus's comment to a group of Jews, "You belong to this world below, I to the world above. Your home is in this world, mine is not." 60. The so-called resurrection witnessed by the apostles when, as they watched, he was lifted up, and a cloud removed him from their sight, and, as they were gazing intently into the sky, all at once there stood beside them 2 men in white who said, "This Jesus, who has been taken away from you up to heaven, will come in the same way as you have seen him go." 61. Paul's experience on the road to Damascus, when suddenly about midday a great light flashed from the sky all around me, and I fell to the ground and Jesus spoke to him. Though unable to hear Jesus's voice, Paul's terrified fellow travelers also saw the brilliant light, which left Paul temporarily blinded. 60. To other possible alien factors to be taken into consideration in this context are Jesus's evidently telepathic ability, in addition to his healing and mastery of teleportation. In one of his 2 books on Christ, theologian Holger Kirsten adduces compelling evidence that Jesus lived in India following his resuscitation, as the original Aramaic word implies, dying there in old age and buried in Srinagar, the capital of Jammu and Kashmir. His tomb still exists in Kashmir, and he is said to be revered there to this day. 63. For die-hard Christians who dismiss the possibility, they should ponder on the fact that the New Testament has only 1 sentence, in Luke, about Jesus's years from the age of 13 to 30. Suppose Jesus had later reincarnated and returned again to earth in the same way as you have seen him go, I doubt that such a revelation would be welcomed, or even believed, by the Christian hierarchy. However, Assuming any truth to Henry Doohan's implication, I am minded to wonder about the claimed connection between Orthon and the two popes cited earlier. Open contact. John L. Peterson served as a flight officer in the U.S. Navy and Navy Reserve and is a decorated veteran of both the Vietnam and Persian Gulf Wars. His government and political experience includes stints at the National War College, the Institute for National Security Studies, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and the National Security Council staff at the White House. Currently he heads the Arlington Institute, a think tank based in Arlington, Virginia. We have met on a number of occasions over the years in Washington. In the Road to 2015, Profiles of the Future, one of three of his books he has given me, he invokes a possible scenario when open contact is made with extraterrestrials, for many in the majority segment of people in industrial societies who believe that UFOs are real. This event, though disquieting, was seen as opening up the window to a whole new world and reality full of immense questions, but not all necessarily negative. There was wonder and questioning in the context of a desire to solidify relationships and learn more from these strange people. At the same time, pockets of people, and some governments, reacted as though acutely threatened. The assumption was that these beings were coming to take over, or unduly influence, the world and that the appropriate response was to quickly build up corporate and individual defenses. All societies with access to television are transfixed by this event. Never before seen levels of global excitement and anxiety are experienced. The implications of this event cause an ultimate change in most every aspect of life on Earth. One of the hardest hit groups are conservative religious organizations, for whom this event does not fit into their relatively narrow explanation of reality. This, perhaps the biggest event in history, causes religious leaders to scramble to explain, and in some cases, modify, theology to fit this new situation. Although some groups see the benefit of the new visitors in terms of new technology that can be made into weapons, many others see it as a hope for solving some of the very serious, intractable problems the world is confronted with at that time. Energy production is of particular interest. 64, all of which may be true. But is open contact a viable scenario? We have learned that many types of aliens populate the cosmos, including Earth. A number of these races, such as those involved in the hybridization programs, definitely do not have our best interests at heart. And those who are on our side in such matters evince an understandable reluctance to engage with us en masse. We remain a relatively primitive bunch. As Daniel Fry, a pioneer rocket technician whose first encounter took place in 1949, was informed by his alien contact, if we were to appear as members of a superior race, coming from above to lead the people of your world, we would seriously disrupt the ego balance of your civilization. Tens of millions of your people, in their desperate need to avoid being demoted to second place in the universe, would go to any conceivable length to disprove or deny our existence. If we took steps to force the realization of our reality upon their consciousness, then about 30% of these people would insist upon considering us as gods, and would attempt to place upon us all responsibility for their own welfare. Of the remaining 70%, most would consider that we were potential tyrants who were planning to enslave their world, and many would immediately begin to seek means to destroy us. If any great and lasting good is to come from our efforts, the actual leaders must be your own people, or it must come from men who are indistinguishable from them. 65, non-disclosure. In November 2011, two petitions with over 17,000 signatories were sent to the White House, one demanding immediate disclosure of the government's knowledge of and communications with extraterrestrial beings. Earlier that month, two petitions with similar aims were able together to garner the required number of signatures to gain a response. The U.S. government has no evidence that any life exists outside our planet, or that an extraterrestrial presence has contacted or engaged any member of the human race, responded Phil Larson from the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. In addition, There is no credible information to suggest that any evidence is being hidden from the public's eye. While conceding the possibility of aliens and a variety of NASA projects aimed at searching for them, Larson stressed there was no credible evidence of extraterrestrial presence here on Earth. Although it's an official White House statement, the "nothing to see here" response is not likely to satisfy public interest, reports journalist Conan Milner. Despite similar statements, one petition cited opinion polls indicating that more than 50% of Americans believe there is an extraterrestrial presence, and more than 80% believe the government is not telling the truth about this phenomenon. 66, Nicola Dupas, unnamed participant in the Amicizia saga, makes some apposite comments regarding disclosure. "The Friends never predicted anything about Disclosure Day. I never heard them speak about 2012, which so many people mention," he added. At the end of the 1940s, the Friends offered their collaboration to the head of the U.S. administration. In exchange, they asked that the nuclear weaponry program be given up. But their offer and request were rejected, and other extraterrestrial populations have been collaborating with the USA and other powers. The results of this have been highly negative. One of the reasons, there are others, which delay disclosure is the fact that the U.S. administration should assume responsibility before the whole planet for having refused a vital collaboration and for having activated another highly negative one, exclusively for the sake of power and domination, lying to citizens and covering up for decades. Following the American politico-military refusal, the Friends undertook the strategy consisting of confidential contacts with small groups of terrestrials, trying to emphasize the quality of human personal relationships. 67, The Royal Society and E.T. In 2011, the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, the world's oldest scientific journal, devoted its edition of January 10 to speculation on alien life in the cosmos. American psychology professor Dr. Albert Harrison, for example, suggested that the discovery of extraterrestrial intelligence may be far less startling for generations that have been brought up with word processors, electronic calculators, avatars, and cell phones, as compared with earlier generations used to typewriters, slide rules, payphones, and rag dolls, surveys suggested. He added that half the population of America and Europe believes aliens exist, and that a substantial proportion was convinced alien spacecraft had already visited Earth. Dr. Harrison also claimed that the discovery of alien life, should it happen any time soon, would be more likely to inspire delight than incite pandemonium here on Earth, he told Space.com. He added that, even if an alien civilization had become greedy and imperialistic, there's no guarantee it would be able to run roughshod over its neighbors. It's possible to have very acquisitive civilizations out there, Harrison conceded. Maybe they get to a certain point, but they may collapse or be beaten back. He added, a comment with which I concur, no one civilization is necessarily going to take over, because there will be coalitions of other civilizations that will keep them in check. 68 At least, we hope so. As for Dr. Harrison's claim that the discovery of aliens would be unlikely to incite pandemonium, in the spring of 2010 a headline on the front page of Al Gad, a local newspaper in Jordan, stated that flying saucers flown by creatures 10 feet tall had landed in the desert town of Jaffa. Amid panic, the mayor, Mohammed Mlia, put the security authorities on full alert. They searched the area, but found nothing. I almost considered evacuating the town's 13,000 residents, said Mlia. Students didn't go to school. People were scared the aliens would attack them. It turned out to have been an April Fool's Day hoax. 69 Panic, however, has featured relatively rarely in actual public landings. Those reported in the UK and Australia in 1955 and 1966, respectively, for example, Chapter 5, engendered astonishment and wonder, but little panic. Predicated on cultural differences, perhaps? When that truth of alien intervention in our planet's affairs and our ongoing contact with an alien culture is finally revealed, states Colonel Philip Cosso, it won't be frightening, even though it will be a shock. 70, The problem, Gary S. Beckham describes himself as an independent occasional rogue journalist, whose international network of contacts includes past and present intelligence officials interested, for example, in the application of exotic phenomena ranging from anti-gravity to mind communication. Beckham shares my conviction that, if the alien presence is real, the odds are against government disclosure, or at least, full disclosure. As he claimed in 2009, among members of the intelligence community, the tale of the alien presence is known as the core story of contact between the aliens and the government. The strong rumor is there is a disturbing aspect to this core story, something so dire that it leaves battle-hardened military types shaking in their boots. According to one of the intelligence officials who pursue the UFO topic, and many are at the highest levels of the government, the core story may fall outside of the President of the United States' need to know. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo astronaut who was the sixth man to walk on the moon, Apollo 14, remains an outspoken supporter of the core story explanation for government secrecy. Mitchell spoke of his contact with a ranking admiral with the Joint Chiefs who agreed to investigate the core story of alien contact and report back. Some reporters were miffed when Mitchell refused to disclose the name of the admiral, but Mitchell did provide to me confirmation that another report was essentially correct. Mitchell requested my help in clarifying why his testimony appeared to be contradicted by the admiral, who had been identified by the Herald Tribune as Rear Admiral Thomas O. Wilson, quoting an article taken from the prestigious Jane's Defense Weekly. Mitchell implied that the admiral had discovered that the core story was protected by a special access program, SAP 71, and SAP is a program imposing need-to-know or access controls beyond those normally provided for access to confidential, secret, or top-secret information. 72 Jane's further defines NSAP as one which must remain unacknowledged when it is considered so sensitive that the fact of its existence is a core secret. Beckham speculates on the disturbing possibility of the existence of government doomsday survival plans in the event of massive extraterrestrial manipulation of the world's population. 73. Anthony L. Kimery, a respected American journalist who has covered global security, intelligence, and defense issues, revealed in 1989 that, according to an Army source who worked with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, JCS, at the Pentagon's National Military Command Center, NMCC, in the 1970s, a highly secret, centralized command structure dealing with UFOs has been in operation since the mid to late 1970s, and, in 1989, continued to handle the UFO problem from the ranks of the NMCC. Kimery believes that military and political leaders have considered the UFO reality serious enough to warrant a consolidated oversight mechanism and planning force, on a par with management for global conflict. 74. That NMCC is, or was, the nerve center dealing with the UFO problem has been confirmed for me by another knowledgeable source. Ancient races. It seems to me that at least some groups of aliens have always been here. In Chapter 13, I allude to reports of possible extraterrestrials described in the Rig Veda, an ancient Indian sacred collection of Vedic Sanskrit hymns. One of the oldest known texts in any Indo-European language, evidence indicates that it was composed between approximately 1700 and 1100 BC, in the early 1900s. Professor Edgar L. Larkin, director of Mount Low Observatory in Southern California, observed on several occasions through a powerful telescope some odd structures in the environs of Mount Shasta. These included two domes rising above the treetops near Shasta and part of a third one. Moving the telescope once again, writes Wisharas Serve, he found visible between the trees a corner of another structure seemingly made of marble. Knowing that there were no such structures in Northern California, and especially in land around Shasta, he left his telescope fixed to see what these things would look like in the setting sun and in darkness. He was surprised to find later in the night that around this dome were great lights, apparently white, which partially illuminated and made them visible even though there was no moon to cast any light at the time. Others reported encounters with extraordinary beings, said to be descendants from the fabled continent of Lemuria, residing in Mount Shasta. In the early 1900s, for example, strange tall humans were seen emerging from forests in the vicinity and visiting local stores in Weed to trade gold nuggets in exchange for basic commodities. Described as graceful and agile, with distinctive features such as large foreheads and long curly hair and dressed in unusual clothes, they were said to have spoken English in a perfect manner with perhaps a tinge of the British accent, and have been reluctant to answer any questions or give any information about themselves. Any intruders approaching them in the vicinity of their hidden residence would invariably be physically removed, or they might encounter some invisible influence, causing temporary paralysis. Also of particular relevance here, cars approaching the area stalled mysteriously and sightings were often made of unusual flying boats, one of which was described by a group of witnesses as a peculiar, silver-like vessel, which was unlike any airship that has ever been seen, and there was absolutely no noise emanating from it. Wishaserv also reports knowledge of records pertaining to another group of descendants from Lemuria, found living in the center of an extinct volcano in Mexico, hidden from all possible worldly observation. 75-76. In an interview for Faith magazine in 2007, a witness, Jason, revealed that on a certain date he had encountered an extraordinary man on the lower slopes of Mount Shasta. "I knew instantly what he was," he told the reporter. "I've lived around here all my life and I've heard the stories." The stranger had flowing white hair and piercing blue eyes. He was wearing white robes and no shoes. "I was scared. It wasn't that he was doing anything threatening, but his appearance there on the side of the mountain was just so unexpected. I jumped up from where I had been lying on the ground, and when I did he looked surprised. It wasn't until I was standing that I realized how tall he was. He had to have been at least 8 feet. He wasn't acting aggressively, but I was unreasonably scared, for some reason. Then he told me not to be afraid. But it was too late for that. I guess he must have realized I was about to lose it, because just like that, he faded and disappeared." 77. In the early 1960s, Lucius, Lou, Farish, a first-class researcher, who sadly died in January 2012, and until several years ago organized the annual OSARC's UFO conference held in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, learned an apocryphal but relevant story from an author who claimed to have met a truly remarkable person in the 1930s. He was about 80 then, an old sailing boat skipper who had participated in the great grain races around the Horn, who called himself only Harmonious, wrote the author. "We used to sit around on the beach and listen while he told us, quietly and without affectation, of his meetings with his astral friends high atop Mount Shasta. Many years later, the first UFOs were sighted near that spot, and of his many trips throughout the system and others. He was bearded, never seemed to change from one year to the next, a vegetarian, and a gentle soul. His description used for the vehicle of flight very closely resembled certain other descriptions now in common usage, all this long before the huge UFO scare. Harmonious was last seen in the late 1950s, and looking exactly as he had 30 years before. He never attempted to capitalize on his experiences." Intrigued, Lou wrote back asking for more details. When he talked of beings on other planets, he was often facetious, the author continued in his reply. However, he was deeply serious whenever he spoke of the Old Ones. Insofar as the Old Ones were concerned, his particular friend used a vehicle that, apparently, was a low-slung gondola, without wheels or any visible means of support or propulsion, for that matter. He'd often pick up a clamshell or half-shell, that is, and say the vehicle looked almost like that. A low couch, nothing else. No top, or sides, or windshields. When it moved, the atmosphere surrounding the vehicle darkened and became opaque, nothing was visible. Also, no feeling of motion, or gravity. Apparently, his friend, an old one, utilized applied levitation as a propulsive force. This vehicle was used only to pick him up and take him to the domain of the Old Ones. This was far beneath the Earth. Usually he entered via a cavern on Mount Shasta, There are other entrances: Antarctica, the Andes. In fact, look at the so-called Circle of Fire on a good geological map and the great faulted areas surrounding the Pacific, and you'll approximate the many areas he mentioned as portals to the old people's world. These old ones dated back several hundred million years, and yet, taking planet Earth as a criterion, there's been more than enough time for 50 such races to have arisen, achieved godlike eminence, decayed, and fallen into silence. Often, in his joking manner, Harmonious spoke of the many planets that are around our sun and are still undiscovered. He was quite casual about the surface features of the planets, probably because he never spent much time there. He was always in them, not on them. I get the impression that there may be others, not of the old people, utilizing these planets. Apparently, these others are of little interest to Harmonious, and, by extension, to his friends, the old ones. They are even something of a joke to him, and again, to the old ones. All the old ones are of one race, both here and on the other planets. They carry on intercourse with one another here on Earth, the planets, and their various natural satellites, all of which are inhabited underground. They have a great many artificial satellites around the gravitational nodes of all these bodies, which are used, I assume, solely for docking facilities for their interplanetary craft. All this was told us by Harmonious long before World War II, and certainly long before the first UFO outcry following the Mount Rainier sightings. The old ones were naked or wore simple loincloths. We found this amusing. To extrapolate from Harmonious's stories of the old people, deep within the core of any planet, the temperature would be controllable given an inexhaustible source of power and knowledge, and such power is inherent in the very force that created this planet. Incidentally, Harmonious anticipated Velikovsky by some years, when he told us of a disaster of unparalleled magnitude that struck the Earth several hundred millions of years ago, and which he saw reproduced by a recording device similar to a moving picture projector, but unlike it in action, a planetoid approached Earth and caused the complete destruction of the existing atmosphere. The only life to survive was that in the depths of the seas and deep underground. If this sort of accident occurs in nature as a matter of course, one could well understand why an ancient and immensely intelligent race would choose to modify their environment and live far underground on all the planets, manufacturing all their necessities. So, according to Harmonious, all the planets are inhabited by a long-lived scientifically advanced race, all living deep beneath the surface, at least well down in the crust. Here it would be about 35 miles down, all humanoid in appearance, and undoubtedly masters of the solar system. There may be others living on the surfaces, undoubtedly, a younger, inferior race, perhaps remnants of other earlier surface races, but far younger than the old ones. On this planet, we are the surface dwellers. We have a long way to go yet, and when we get there, the old ones will have been the first, and long since moved on. Considering the foregoing information, concludes Lou Farish, perhaps we should reconsider all the various writings on underground civilizations inhabited by advanced cultures, or extraterrestrials, as well as books such as the late M.K. Jessop's The Case for the UFO. 78 Jessop's comments on the use of gravitational nodes by alien spacecraft echo the remarks of Harmonious. If it is accepted that there is someone out there who is visiting the Earth, should we then consider that there may also be someone down there? 79. I have always been fascinated by the Comte de Saint Germain, his most frequently used pseudonym, another of which was the Count de Weldon. Described by Voltaire in his Evers as a man who never dies, and who knows everything and capable of astonishing feats, as witnessed for example by Count Alessandro Cagliostro, the occultist Giuseppe Balsamo, Saint Germain seems to have lived for an indeterminate period. Held by many to be a charlatan, he nonetheless liaised with, and was respected by, many government ministers and royal families in Europe, such as the court of Louis XIV. He was also an accomplished violinist and composer. In connection with Harmonious, it is perhaps apposite to note that Dr. Anton Mesmer, also an occultist and fine musician, numbering Mozart and Haydn among his friends, founded the Harmonious Society, a secret group of savants based in Vienna and later Paris, and received a great deal of help from Street Germain. 80. It seems likely to me that Street Germain and others of his kind were associated with the ancient races.